This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. You regular listeners know that freedom of information, a particular passion of ours, has lately become an obsession. And it's fixated on the veil of secrecy that shrouds customs and border protection, the huge police force guarding our borders. We know we have fewer rights at the borders, but that's all we know. We don't know what rights we retain or how they're attenuated by CBP policies under the aegis of the Department of Homeland Security because we don't have access to that policy. All we have are countless stories, countless because we can't get the data, of dehumanizing detentions and intrusions at the border that would seem to be unconstitutional anywhere else.
So we're devoting this hour to the murk at the border, how we can penetrate it, and why we ought to try. And since we don't have and can't get hard numbers, we'll use stories. The first, the one that started us on this quest, you may have heard before. It's from OTM producer Sarah Abdurrahman, who was headed back to New York from her cousin's wedding near Toronto when she was detained along with a carload of family and friends for 6 hours without explanation by U.S. Border Patrol agents at Niagara Falls. Everyone in the car was a U.S. citizen.
Once we realized we wouldn't be leaving the border facility anytime soon, the giddiness we still had from the wedding weekend quickly disappeared.
Head started to slump between shoulders. All conversations ceased. I remember at one point trying to fall asleep, but I was just so cold. I couldn't do it.
Sufiana Amri was one of the 6 people in our car.
I felt like they were a bunch of frat boys, and we were a bunch of initiatives just sitting there awaiting their judgment. Because I remember they would snicker and kind of look at us and comment, and they would kind of whisper among themselves and laugh.
It was freezing.
That's Abdullah, my husband.
Everybody was like putting their arms in their shirt, and there was points where my teeth were chattering.
There's probably no form of Border Patrol abuse that's better documented than that. People have reported being held in extreme cold, and they call it the ice box.
James Lyle is an attorney at the ACLU of Arizona. He says in addition to the ice box, people have reported physical and verbal abuse, as well as denial of food, water, or medical care by Customs and Border Protection, or CBP, which is under the Department of Homeland Security.
The accounts are so widespread and so consistent that it's very hard to see this as anything other than a systemic problem and not just a couple of bad apples here or there.
Lyle told me the story of 4-year-old Emily Ruiz, who was detained for 20 hours at Dulles Airport.
She was crying hysterically, and agents refused to let her speak with her parents for over 14 hours. They kept her in a cold room with no bed, blanket, or pillow, and didn't give her anything to eat other than a cookie and some soda.
Even though she was a U.S. citizen, CBP ultimately deported the little girl. She returned to the U.S. 3 weeks later and was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder.
The fact is, it's not necessary to abuse citizens and permanent residents or anyone to do the work of a Customs and Border Protection official. And yet, there aren't any meaningful mechanisms holding Customs and Border Protection officials in check, and so there's a real sense of impunity.
Lyle says this is partially due to the sheer size of CBP, which has grown into the largest federal law enforcement agency in the country.
With that growth, there was no accompanying rise in transparency, oversight, accountability that you would expect to see from any law enforcement agency, much less one that claims such broad authority. The picture that emerges is really of an agency that's grown too much, too far, too fast, and is at times operating really as an agency out of control.
I tried asking the guy in charge, Supervisor McPherson, why we were held for so long. He said it wasn't my right to know. I asked him the names of the agents who interacted with us and was once again told it wasn't my right to know. Earlier this week, I called Richard Misdell, the public affairs liaison at the Buffalo Service Port, and asked him if McPherson's response was in line with CBP policy.
In a situation like that, normally we would provide the names of the officers, but in this instance, he did give you his name, so...
Well, he didn't give me his name. I wrote it down because he was facing me and I could write it down. He wouldn't give me his first name. When I asked for the names of the other agents, they turned around so I couldn't write their names down. Mm-hmm. Is it against CBP policy for U.S. citizens to have the names of the agents they interact with?
I would have to investigate that for you. I wouldn't want to speculate.
So you don't know?
I'd have to investigate that for you.
Is it the CBP policy not to inform people of why they're being held for extended periods of time?
each situation is different. To try to make a statement broad enough to cover all would be, you know, asinine. There's no way that could be done.
Later, we learned that other friends that had been at the wedding in Toronto were also detained, also for 6 hours, at the Detroit border crossing. Khalid Ahmed and his wife were driving with their two small children, his brother, and a family friend. Again, all U.S. citizens. They said their first interaction with a CBP agent signaled what was to come.
You know, I was like, hi, how are you doing today? No response. Stern look from the beginning. Who's Khalid? Are you Khalid? Yes, I'm Khalid. Who's Lubab? Lubab right here. Okay, which one is Muna? That's Muna. At this point in time, my son, who had just turned 3 years old, was in the back seat. He kind of popped his head out and he's like, hi, my name is Fethi. He just turned to him. He's like, what? What did you say your name was? What's your name? Really aggressively to this 3-year-old kid.
They were told to park and leave all their cell phones in the car. At which point his wife, Ala, asked if anyone would be going through their phones.
Because I wear a headscarf, I have pictures on there that if somebody's going to search the phone, I need it to be a female.
And the man said that nobody was going to be checking our phones. So we went ahead and left our phones in the car.
My phone doesn't have a code, but Khalid's does have a lock. So they brought it in and they told him, we need you to unlock your phone. We're going to search through it.
It went from, we won't search your phones, to, we're going to search your phone, confiscate it, and not give it back to you. I got into an argument with the officer. I said, listen, all my work is on my phone. I really need it. He got aggressive with me and said, listen, you're not leaving with your phone today.
Khalid told me he put his foot down about his phone because he saw another friend who was detained that day do the same thing. When Khalid's group arrived at the Detroit border crossing, they found Ahmed Gdoura, another Toronto wedding guest and U.S. citizen, already being detained with his family at the CBP facility.
I just kept on begging him, I'm like, you can't take my phone. This is my work phone. I'm on call 24/7, so I have to have my phone. And after begging them, he said, you can come tomorrow to pick it up.
ACLU attorney Catherine Crump says that the government can search people's electronic devices at the border without any suspicion that they contain evidence of wrongdoing.
And once the government has a copy of someone's electronic information, it's relatively easy for that to be shared among government agencies, and the policy even permits sharing with state and local governments and with foreign governments too.
Back at Niagara Falls, we had our phones confiscated as well, and my husband was asked to unlock his. The government says only around 15 of the 1.1 million people who enter the U.S. each day have their electronic devices searched by Border Patrol agents. If that's true, our three cars may have accounted for almost all of CBP's device searches that day. DHS has an internal office of civil rights and civil liberties, which Crump says encourages CBP agents to write an explanation of why a device search is taking place. But it's not a requirement, though she thinks it should be.
Because anything you can do to make people create some record of why they're conducting searches would help cut down on searches that are conducted for impermissible reasons, such as, for example, merely because of the racial or ethnic background of the person involved or because of their religious beliefs.
When my husband Abdullah was taken to another room for interrogation by a DHS officer, the questions quickly focused on his religious beliefs.
He asks me if I'm Muslim, but he kind of does it in this weird way. Like, he's like, can I ask you, what religion are you? Like that, you know, like it kind of like dances around it. And I was like, yes, I'm Muslim. He said, are you practicing? I said, yes. He said, where do you practice? And I was immediately confused by that question because, I mean, Muslims don't really belong to a church or a mosque or whatever. I practice wherever.
We've noticed a pattern of CBP agents asking Muslim travelers really invasive and personal questions about their protected religious activity.
Munya Jabbar, an attorney at the Council on American Islamic Relations, says questions about religious behavior violate the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution.
You're singling out people based on their religion and then subjecting them to longer detentions and to humiliating questioning about stuff that they're allowed to do legally. In fact, stuff that is part of the bedrock of our Bill of Rights.
What about the people who say, okay, well, so what? We inconvenience a few Muslims. We ask them some questions that might be uncomfortable or invasive, but whatever, if they're not doing anything wrong, no big deal. In the meantime, we might potentially catch somebody who is actually a threat to this country. Isn't it worth it?
No, because the questions are just so broad. I don't possibly see how those kinds of questions would actually help them flesh out any kind of terrorism investigation. When you pull aside innocent people for questioning, there's a stigma that they have done something wrong, and that stigma is also harmful.
I got called in at least 5 or 6 separate occasions. Every single time they called me in, they would search me.
That's Khalid.
Aggressively search me, push my forehead up against the concrete wall, going in between my legs, digging in my private areas. They send me back for 10 or 15 or 20 minutes and call me back again and search me again.
Did you ask them why they had to do a body search every time?
I just laughed. The only way I knew how to deal with it was laugh. I just kept laughing. I was like, do you have any weapons on you? No, sir. You just searched me, and I went and sat back down in the same seat. I don't know where you think I could have gotten weapons from, you know? At some point, to get over the depression of the situation, you just have to treat it as a joke.
Some of the treatment, I think, can be fairly dehumanizing. For example, when CBP cuffs a parent in front of their kids, that can be terrifying to families, and it seems really needlessly terrifying.
And that's exactly what happened to Khalid at the Detroit border.
After we had been there about 5.5 hours, a man came out, put handcuffs on me, and took me to a back room that was basically a jail cell. They didn't tell me what was going on. My only request is I just asked one of them, whenever you guys find out what's going on, can you please just tell my family? Can you just inform my family?
Not only did they not tell his family what was going on, they led them to think the worst. While Khalid was still in the jail cell, the rest of his group got their passports back and were told they could leave. Here's his wife, Ella.
Khalid's brother asked, you know, where's Khalid? And I just told him, oh, I'm sure he's coming out right now. And then when I've already walked away from the desk, the agent tells me, oh, he won't be joining you guys. I was like, what? You know, I go up to the desk and like, what do you mean? He's like, oh, there's an agency coming to pick him up. I was like, well, what agency? He's like, I can't disclose that information with you. I was like, he's my husband. You need to tell me where he is going. We waited here 6 hours. We're American citizens. Don't treat us like we're criminals. Don't treat us like we've done something wrong. And he made it seem like it was the FBI coming to get him, like this was something serious. And then I just broke down.
Turned out, Khalid had an unpaid ticket for having a crooked license plate, which he got back in 2006. The other agency coming to get him was Michigan State Police.
I really don't understand the rationale of terrifying and humiliating families in that manner with those kind of tactics.
Munya Jabbar.
CBP apparently has essentially a kind of customer service notice up in their facilities, but they're definitely not following through on that kind of customer service.
I saw that customer service notice when I was being detained. It was a list of CBP's pledges to travelers entering the U.S. I read some of those out to my friends and family to see how well they thought CBP did.
We pledge to cordially greet and welcome you to the United States.
I mean, that was anything but cordial. It was definitely not a welcome. It was more like a, you are not welcome.
We pledge to treat you with courtesy, dignity, and respect.
There was not a single courtesy given. Even the bathroom was an ordeal. It was an uphill battle. Absolutely no dignity at all. We were antagonized from the start. From the cold air to the terrible seats to the heightened tension and the fact that they were kind of laughing on their end of the room, kind of looking over at us like we were huddled sheep for the slaughter.
It was one of the lowest moments of dignity in my life.
We pledge to explain the CBP process to you.
Never. Not once did anybody explain to us what was happening or what procedures were to be followed or anything.
It was almost like a joke, like a Saturday Night Live sketch. Like saying, we pledge to put you in a black room and they put us in a white room, for example. They would just do literally the opposite of everything that they said.
I repeatedly asked Richard Misdal, the one CBP official I managed to get on the line, why our detainment was so starkly different than the experience CBP promises travelers. And repeatedly got the same response.
The way that we would handle this situation, ma'am, and I know it's going to sound like a broken record here, but it's through DHS TRIP. DHS TRIP, what they'll do is they'll take all the information. It all goes to headquarters. Headquarters looks at the information. They disseminate it down to the port level. The port level goes through, talks to all the key components that were involved with the case. They'll write up a response to it, and the response will go to headquarters, and headquarters will issue it to you.
The complainant is unlikely to receive any information about the course of the investigation, they very regularly receive a cursory dismissal letter.
ACLU attorney, James Lyle.
I heard one case of someone who submitted a complaint to the Office of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties, and they were referred to the TRIP program. And then in turn, the TRIP program, when it was done processing their information, referred them back to OCRCL, a kind of bureaucratic hot potato.
Really?
Yeah.
Referred them back for what?
Further investigation, supposedly.
And remember Ahmed Gadoura, whose phone was kept overnight? He's often experienced difficulty at border crossings, so he actually went through DHS TRIP and obtained a redress number, presumably to make travel easier in the future.
This past time, the first guy, when he takes your passports, I told him I have a redress number. He's like, I don't need it. It's not going to make a difference. I was held for 7 hours, and that was the longest I've ever been held. And this is after I've gotten a redress number. I feel like I'm a second-class citizen, where every time I'm trying to get into the country, you get dehumanized, you get treated like an animal, pretty much.
They make you feel like a foreigner in your own country. And that's the psychology of it, you know. Honestly, like, it's still kind of throwing me off. They really mess with your head while you're in there.
To be in a situation where you're a father and you can't protect your children or do anything for them, it's not easy to sit through, to feel so helpless.
This is my home. So it was very much a betrayal, a cocktail of emotions, anger, sadness, depression, hopelessness, helplessness. And I remember anger slowly, slowly rising to the top, eclipsing all other ones, because I just felt like, I did not deserve this. I am not a criminal. I am not in possession of anything illegal. I am an American. Open the damn door and let me back home.
For On the Media, I'm Sara Abdurrahman.
Sarah joins us in the studio now. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Brooke.
So you wanted to do an investigation because of what happened to you.
Yeah, I genuinely came out of the experience wondering what our rights are. I approached CBP and DHS headquarters asking very direct questions
like,
you know, is there a time limit on how long someone can be detained? Do people have to unlock their phones if asked? Do agents have to inform you why you're being detained? And I didn't even approach them as like an angry citizen. I approached them as a journalist who had very straightforward questions just about the process and the protocol. And what I discovered doing that is that the lack of transparency that I saw during our detainment just continued up and up and up the ranks all the way to DC, where nobody was getting back to me about anything.
How many times did you actually try?
I tried a bunch of times. I don't even know. I mean, I made phone calls. I sent emails. I tried to get DHS. I tried to get the Civil Liberties and Civil Rights Office. I tried to get CBP.
The Department of Homeland Security's Civil Rights Unit did its own investigation of rights violations at the border. It pretty much exonerated the CBP and then classified its report. Now, the ACLU told you that when it finally got the report, the Civil Rights Office had redacted its reasons for clearing the CBP. This is just weird.
Yeah, and everybody that I talked to gave me the impression that the Civil Rights and Civil Liberties Office is pretty much a toothless unit within the Department of Homeland Security. It's strange to me that even those oversight agencies are opaque. It seems like from top to bottom, people can just fall back on, you know, it's sensitive information, we can't tell you. And the danger in that is they can say that about anything.
You always felt yourself to be untouchable, even though you wear a headscarf and you're from a place where there's searing heat and endless numbers of guns.
And oil.
Yeah.
Texas.
Exactly.
I'm from Texas. That was one of the hardest things when we were done with our detainment. I really just felt so stupid. Like, how naive was I to think that when we came back into the country, all smiles and happy to be home, that this wouldn't happen? You know, you always hear this over and over and over again. You don't do anything wrong. You've got nothing to hide. You're fine. And I really thought, if there's due process, if there's a legal system, and I haven't done anything wrong, then nobody will treat me that way. And if somebody does treat me that way, there's going to be some sort of accountability later for that. And what I'm discovering is there's nothing that any of us can do. Absolutely nothing. Those guys at the front lines that have no oversight on what they're doing, they're the invincible ones.
After Sara's experience last September, we called Lee Hamilton, former congressman and current member of the U.S. Homeland Security Advisory Council, and he gave us this advice.
I would go to my representatives. I'd say, look, this is outrageous. I was treated poorly. I tried to get it corrected. They didn't do anything about it. I want you to write a letter to the Secretary of DHS. I want you to make sure that in hearings, the bureaucrats are asked about this and why it happened.
So Sarah went to the office of her local representative, Democrat Carolyn Maloney, and asked for help. Months later, it's not clear how much Maloney or anyone can do.
I've sent three letters, one to Customs and Border Protection and others to the Department of Homeland Security. Customs and Border Protection basically kicked it over to TRIP. My most recent letter to TRIP was sent on January 22nd.
As a citizen and as a journalist, it's incredibly frustrating, you know, to get such non-answers from the government. For you, is it equally frustrating or is it sort of just a routine, predictable part of the job?
A routine part of the job. Sometimes, you know, you write a letter, they never get back, but then the person's no longer detained, you know, so you feel that you did something to help them.
This process that we've been going through with your office now for the past several months, do you imagine that it's going to yield any results, some sort of accountability?
Sarah, no one in the CARS was given his or her right to due process of the law, and that is an issue because due process requires that you know the charges against you.
What kind of pressure can you put on them?
Well, I think having in writing letter after letter after letter builds a case against their competency. They don't respond appropriately.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Carolyn Maloney represents New York's 12th Congressional District, where I live.
Coming up, we offer two more stories about stuff that shouldn't happen, at least the way it happens, at the border.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Lumosity.com, designed by neuroscientists to work out your brain in a fun and challenging way. Lumosity offers personalized training programs to challenge your memory, attention, or processing speed. Lumosity users can train from anywhere with a computer or from an iPhone or iPad using the Lumosity app. Visit Lumosity.com, click the Start Training button to start playing today, and select On the Media from the drop-down menu.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. You wouldn't expect a local police officer to demand you hand over your laptop or phone without a warrant, but CBP does, and in December, a federal judge upheld its right to do so. That decision was a blow to Pascal Abidur, a graduate student in Islamic studies at McGill University. He's the one who sued the government back in 2010 after CBP seized his laptop and kept it for 11 days. Here's his story of what happened when agents who boarded his Amtrak train from Montreal to New York took him aside for screening.
She turns on my laptop, says, put in your password, please. And without thinking, I just enter my password. Almost immediately, she's shocked, but almost laughing, and she's signaling to her coworkers to, like, come look at what's on this screen. It was pictures of Hezbollah rallies and Hamas rallies.
Yeah.
I mean, like,
Why did you have that?
That was the question at the time. And I said, well, it's all stuff I got, either, you know, photos that accompanied New York Times and other newspaper articles, or I Google image searched and I downloaded some stuff. My research is on the Shiites of South Lebanon. So you're going to talk about Hezbollah at some point.
Are you Muslim?
I was raised atheist. My mom's French and my dad is a Jew from Brooklyn, but they raised me not as a believer.
You just chose Islamic studies because it happens to be in the headlines the last dozen years?
I would even go like 20 years. I can remember the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air being interrupted by the Gulf War. I think I have more than enough reason to be interested in it. And her reaction was, Hezbollah? It's not even an object of study. It's the enemy, apparently.
So what did she do?
She told me, we can't hold up the rest of the train for you, so we're going to have to take you back to the port. I was not under arrest, but they would need to frisk me and put me in handcuffs. They took me to the port and put me in a detention cell. As soon as the door locked, I thought I was going to throw up. I was afraid that I was about to be disappeared. It sounds hyperbolic, but it's true. I really thought I was going to Guantanamo Bay.
And the room itself?
Freezing cold. Even my jacket was not warm enough. It was like a meat locker. Every once in a while, someone would come in, just ask me one or two questions. Do you have a tattoo on your ribs? Have you ever had piercings? Asking me questions derived from photos on my MySpace page. Eventually, they came in and they said, okay, we have to ask you a whole bunch of questions. And they walked me to an interrogation room.
Describe the interrogation.
Basically, every question you are raised as an American to never have to be required to answer.
Like?
What religion were you raised? What is the religion of your parents? Are you a member of any political parties or political organizations or activist groups? Have you ever been to a mosque? Have you ever been to a rally, meaning in the Middle East? Had I ever witnessed a flag burning? Would I join a rally or a flag burning if I saw one? They put me back in the cell, and a guy came and he introduced himself as a liaison from the FBI. And he asked me really, really, really detailed questions about my research. He got the most detailed synopsis of my research for my PhD that anyone had ever received, including my supervisor. He was like, oh, have you ever thought of working for the government? I told him, maybe if you guys didn't do this to me.
So eventually they let you go.
When they let me out of the cell, there's, you know, the tables where your stuff gets examined, and my stuff is exploded everywhere. Well, let me rephrase that. Mm-hmm. My stuff is scattered everywhere. And as I'm gathering my stuff, they said, you know, we're going to have to hold onto your laptop and your external hard drive. And then they told me, you'll wait for a bus to come and you'll ask the bus driver if there is a seat free for you to take back to New York.
Just give me a kind of overview of what it felt like that day.
The single scariest experience of my life. I was held for 4 to 5 hours. It doesn't seem like a lot of time, but I wasn't given a phone call. No one knew where I was. They could have done anything and nobody would have known anything. I left this experience as though a bunch of gangsters threatened and intimidated me, gleeful in messing with me. When I got back to New York, I was not in a good way. I became convinced that I was being followed, that something bad would happen around me, and then I would be blamed for it. I wasn't comfortable taking the train. When I would walk in circles around blocks or randomly change direction. It messed me up for a good long while. And I had an appointment set up with the ACLU. I said, if you help me get my laptop back, I will help you guys with anything you want to do with this case. This can't happen again. It's crazy. So they drafted a letter, sent it on Monday. Tuesday morning, I got a call from Claim Property at the Champlain port telling me, I have your laptop and your external hard drive. Where can I send it back? And I got it Wednesday.
But it wasn't working so well.
Yeah, my external hard drive had been pried open and not resealed. And the keyboard had been removed and not replaced all the way.
The contents had been copied by the government. Lots of personal stuff.
Oh, yeah. They have the right to copy it and distribute the information to whatever agencies they deem should receive it.
They can send it to foreign governments, too.
Interesting, considering in the judge's ruling, he does implicitly compare the United States to the government of Bashar al-Assad.
In what way?
That, you know, Bashar al-Assad and the allies of Hezbollah would search my laptop, so why shouldn't the U.S. government? And more importantly, that it happens so little that why should there even be a legal decision on the case? You know, the ACLU, what they wanted to do was challenge the very constitutionality of a suspicionless search. And there is as yet no policy. You know, in the constitutional challenge to the policy, the judge himself cites CBP policy saying that they're allowed to do it.
The CBP can unilaterally pass laws regarding the civil rights of citizens at the border.
And the entire territory of their jurisdiction, which extends much deeper into America than the border.
Pascal, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Brooke.
Pascal Abidor is a PhD student at McGill University.
Avoid inconvenience, said the judge in the Pascal Abidor case. Travelers should simply leave whatever they don't want searched at home. That wasn't an option for the anonymous Jane Doe, a 54-year-old woman from New Mexico whose privacy was violated right down to the viscera. She's being represented by ACLU lawyer Laura Schauer Ives, who says her client was pulled aside for a secondary search while entering El Paso from Juarez and sent to a lineup. Then a CBP dog jumped on her, which Ives says was the impetus for what happened next. If you're squeamish, we advise you to turn your radio down for a few minutes, because the description of this search is necessarily graphic.
The agents asked her to remove her pants and to crouch down, spread her genitalia, and cough. They asked her to bend forward. They shone a flashlight on her anus and visually inspected that area. They then asked her to lean backwards, holding herself up with her back arms, and they did the same to her vagina.
They found no drugs, so, as Jane Doe tells it, this is what happened next. She was handcuffed and sent to a local medical center for more invasive measures. She asked if they had a search warrant. They said they didn't need one. They handcuffed her to a bed, made her ingest a laxative, and observed the inevitable result. Still no drugs. They x-rayed her. Still no drugs. At this point, Laura Ives says her client was in tears. Still handcuffed to the bed, she was told by a doctor to spread her legs.
He first inserted a speculum into her vagina and observed visually. He then put his fingers or hand in her vagina and his other hand on top of her abdomen and rubbed in between. He did the same with a rectal exam. While this is happening, the residents are watching, the agents are watching, the door is open. There's absolutely no privacy given to her. And also not the general kind of comforting direction that a physician usually provides a woman in say, like a gynecological exam, where they say, I'm going to
do this. This will be cold.
Right. There was none of that. It was order after order with them violating her. And she felt sexually assaulted.
Next on the list, according to the complaint, a CAT scan. And just like the search at the port of entry, the forced bowel movement, x-ray and cavity exams, it revealed nothing. After 6 hours of invasive searches, Jane Doe was free to go.
Then the agents told her that if she signed a consent form, they would ensure that the hospital didn't charge her. But if she refused, the hospital would send her a bill.
Refuse, she did, and send her a bill, they did, just shy of $6,000. A nurse told her that her ordeal was pretty routine, not to Jane Doe.
Jane Doe is not unlike many other victims of sexual assault. She's unable to leave the house without fear. Whenever she recounts this event, she cries. She's unable to be intimate with her husband. And the people who are supposed to protect us, physicians and law enforcement, perpetrated this.
The ACLU filed suit on her behalf against the agents, the hospital, and the doctors, claiming that her Fourth and 14th Amendment rights had been violated. Ives says that while it's true that there are diminished constitutional protections at the border, this case is outrageous enough to shock the conscience of the court.
With every search, they had more and more information that whatever suspicion they originally had was mistaken. This search done in our names, I can't imagine it would ever be worth it. This shouldn't happen to any other of our fellow citizens.
Laura Shower Ives is an attorney with the ACLU of New Mexico. CBP in El Paso gave us this statement, quote, CBP stresses honor and integrity in every aspect of our mission, and the overwhelming majority of CBP employees and officers perform their duties with honor and distinction, working tirelessly every day to keep our country safe. We do not tolerate corruption or abuse within our ranks, and we fully cooperate with any criminal or administrative investigations of alleged misconduct by any of our personnel on or off duty.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Pantheon, publishers of The News, A User's Manual, by philosopher and best-selling author Alain de Botton, whose new book shows us how the news shapes the way we understand the world. often in ways we are not fully aware of. Available now at your preferred bookseller. For more information, go to alainedebotton.com.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The murkiness around CBP policies extends far beyond detainment procedure, warrantless device searches, or even medieval cavity examinations. It also obscures the use of deadly force at the border. An investigation by the Arizona Republic has found that since 2005, on-duty Border Patrol and Customs and Border Protection agents have killed at least 42 people, at least 13 of whom were American citizens. Some were killed by agents firing across the border into Mexico. But federal investigations into those incidents can take years to be released, and both their processes and their conclusions entirely invisible to the public, even where victims are unarmed teenagers shot from behind. Bob Ortega is one of the journalists behind the Republic's investigation. Bob, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks. Very glad to be with you.
Your series describes a number of extremely disturbing incidents, but I want to focus on one in the fall of 2012. It involved a kid in Nogales shot to death by a border agent.
Jose Antonio Elena Rodriguez was shot to death. According to his family, he was merely walking to visit his brother, who was working at a convenience store that's right next to the border fence. According to agents, there were some people throwing rocks at them just before they fired. A Border Patrol agent, at least one, maybe two, began to fire through the fence and hit this boy 10 times in the back and in the head, killing him on the spot.
Clearly a troubling incident. And you approached the Border Patrol and you said, who was the officer? What is the state of the case? Has there been a criminal investigation? And what were you told?
Well, nothing. The Border Patrol and Customs and Border Protection have a policy that they do not release the names of agents. They do not release any details whatsoever about any actions that they may or may not take internally. And by the way, even their own policies on use of force are secret. They will not release those to the public. Most law enforcement bodies do. What they've said in this and in many other cases that we've investigated is that they can't say anything because it's being investigated by the FBI. And so they defer ostensibly to the FBI, although in fact they do conduct their own parallel investigations, and they don't release any of that information at all, ever.
You filed well over 100 FOIA requests.
Yes, that's right.
What came back from those?
A lot of them we're still fighting. In one of them, we wound up getting 12,000 pages of use of incident reports from Customs and Border Protection. And then also hundreds of pages of incidents in which firearms were used. And a lot of the information was redacted. But often we were able to piece together information using a combination of what we found in those files with information that we got separately from the FBI, with public records that we requested from state and local law enforcement officials. We also did a lot of on-the-ground reporting. But it was very interesting because if you look at the patterns, the vast majority of the time, Border Patrol agents don't use deadly force. They're able to deal with situations by using less lethal weapons, like they have these things that look like paintball guns that fire pepper balls. In every one of the incidents that we tracked in which an agent shot someone, they reacted with firearms in circumstances that were practically identical to those that many, many more agents reacted to without using deadly force.
Now, when you say a lot of the documents were redacted, how redacted? I mean, are we talking about FOIA being the new black?
Yeah. Well, a lot of the redactions were bogus. There's certain specific exemptions in FOIA law that are perfectly understandable. If you have an ongoing investigation, for example, you're allowed to redact information that could interfere with the course of that investigation. You're allowed to redact information that would violate an individual's privacy. But if you're asking for something like what an agent was doing while he's performing his official function, I don't think that's protected by privacy.
The claims to privacy and security on behalf of its agents might hold a little bit more water if the Department of Homeland Security and the CBP didn't have a deal with the National Geographic Channel for a reality TV show called Border Wars, which shows the Border Patrol in action.
Exactly. And the thing that's ironic about this is that when we talk to CBP they maintain that they don't release the names of agents because if they're identified by the Mexican cartels, they could be in danger. And yet, every week on this program, there's faces of the agents, the names of the agents, where they work, what they're doing. My perception is that it's because they see that as a useful recruiting tool and that the issue has really very little to do with privacy and more to do with whether the agency is able to control the message that is being put out.
And we're not just talking about guys with beige uniforms and 9mm strapped to them. We're talking about the public information officers who give you what answers you get. They won't even be quoted by name?
That's right. They'll give us a single statement attributed just to CBP. They're seeking anonymity for everything that they say and do. If you're a spokesman, you should be willing to identify yourself. Right after our series ran, I had a conversation with a retired Border Patrol sector chief. You know, he didn't like everything about the story because he didn't think it was particularly friendly to the Border Patrol. But he did say, if you look at what we do, we meaning the Border Patrol, we, on behalf of the American people, are given authority to wield deadly force under certain circumstances. And yet, the government turns around and says to the American people, we're not going to tell you under what circumstances. And he said, that's absurd on its face. This is a former Border Patrol sector chief. The use of force policy of Customs and Border Protection used to be public. It only stopped being public in 2004 once they were part of the Department of Homeland Security.
The Office of the Inspector General for the Department of Homeland Security is supposed to be the internal watchdog of the conduct of the agency and its employees. That's what they're there for.
That's right.
Their findings were kind of jaw-dropping.
In one part of the report, the OIG report, the inspector said many agents really don't know as well as they should when to use or not to use deadly force. What was ironic about it, though, to me, was that all of the recommendations for improvements or change were redacted. In fact, we spoke with several members of our congressional delegation after it came out to see if perhaps they had been able to take a look at an unredacted version, and even they were only given redacted versions of the report. And these are the guys who asked for the investigation in the first place.
Bob, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bob Ortega is an investigative reporter at the Arizona Republic.
The following has happened to Terry Bressy, a staff engineer at the University of Arizona, Tucson, more than 300 times.
Sir, are you a citizen?
I don't have to answer that question, sir.
What country are you a citizen of?
Again, I'm sorry, I don't have to answer that question, sir.
I'm ordering you to park over there in lane two.
It happens on his regular commute to the Kitt Peak National Observatory on an east-west highway 40 miles north of the Mexican border. He records the episodes because he's been hauled from his car and charged for being uncooperative when stopped by U.S. border authorities at checkpoints nowhere near the border. Beto O'Rourke, who represents the 16th District of Texas, including the city of El Paso, concedes that it's long been assumed that people at ports of entry must endure some suspension of due process protections, but that in light of DHS opacity, a mushrooming CBP, and that movable border, we need a new law.
When you live on the border, that suspension of some of the due process and protections that you have extends up to 100 miles from the border, Canadian or Mexican. It's one of those things that we've put up with on the border for a really long time that I realize that we really shouldn't be putting up with. On a daily basis, people come to our office who have just crossed the bridge and waited in line for 2 hours, in extreme cases, 3 hours, to cross into the United States. They get to the front of that line. They talk to a Customs and Border Protection officer. They are treated with less than respect or maybe even abused. And then when they want to complain, they have to complain to that officer's superior. No accountability, ultimately.
You and 19 other members of Congress sent a letter to the acting commissioner there, Thomas Winkowski, and you asked, among other things, for CBP's use of force policy handbook. Did you get it?
We have not.
Why not?
I don't know. And we're certainly going to be persistent, but we're not going to just stop there. We are soon to introduce with Steve Pierce, Republican, a representative of Southern New Mexico, the bill that will create a border oversight commission with subpoena authority so that we could get the answers. It would create an ombudsman so that if you have a serious allegation of abuse, you can file that immediately, and there's one source that you can go to make sure that that's investigated and that there is some accountability. And it's important for me to say I really respect and am grateful for the work that those CBP officers do. I think it's probably one of the toughest jobs that you can have in federal employment. Very unpredictable, potentially very dangerous. However, we must treat every single person who comes through those ports of entry with the highest respect and not treat anyone in a way that they feel that they have been abused. And we do have those documented cases of abuse.
We spoke ourselves to the attorney for Jane Doe, a person about whom you wrote a letter to Commissioner Winkowski in December.
This is an awful case and deeply embarrassing to me as an El Pasoan and as an American. What we want to know is how widespread are these kinds of abuses? And again, it gets back to this issue of oversight. We are not able to get those numbers to date from the acting commissioner, Thomas Winkowski. We want to make sure that there's a statutory requirement to provide this information so that we have the kind of accountability that's necessary for us to have a functional border that treats people with respect.
So give it to me absolutely straight, Congressman. As someone who sits on the House Committee on Homeland Security, how much influence does Congress have to impel any information from DHS at this point?
DHS and specifically Customs and Border Protection and our current acting commissioner, on most of our routine day-to-day issues that we bring up with them, have been very responsive. In these issues of accountability and oversight, when it comes to agents and officers who have potentially abused border crossers and U.S. citizens, they have been less than forthcoming, less than responsive. When we're trying to understand the scope and the depth of the problems that we have here. And again, that's why we're not simply going to rely on our ability to request this information as individual members of Congress, but we want to put something into law that compels DHS and its sub-agencies to turn over information when we request it, because we're having this problem right now, and also make sure that the person who is entering our ports of entry has those safeguards and protections and a single source that they can go to file a complaint and expect a response in a reasonable amount of time, something that we are not getting today.
Is it just politically untenable to question these things?
You know, security comes first in so many people's minds. So you've seen an explosion in assets and resources and force on the border without enough training, without enough oversight, without enough checks and balances. I think this is just too politically convenient for people to beef up border security. It sounds good. It appeals to an emotional anxiety that many Americans have about our border. It's much more difficult when you look at the underlying facts and find that El Paso is the safest city in the country, that the U.S. side of the U.S.-Mexico border is far safer than the interior of this country, and that we really don't have a border security problem anywhere near the rhetoric that we're hearing in the Capitol.
Thank you so much, Congressman.
Thank you. Thanks for your attention to this issue.
Congressman Beto O'Rourke represents Texas' 16th Congressional District, which includes the border city of El Paso, and he serves on the House Committee on Homeland Security. As we heard from Lee Hamilton, there is no better, or perhaps no other, way of demanding accountability from DHS than contacting your local representative and asking them to do so on your behalf. To that end, we created a web tool with the help of our friends in the WNYC Data News Team. It's extremely simple to use. When you click the button that says, "Call your representative," you will be prompted to enter your phone number. A few seconds later, your phone will ring and you'll be put through to the office of your representative. After we launched the tool a few months ago, we checked in with some listeners to get feedback about the experience of actually using it. In order, you'll hear Ehud Gavron, Philip Elmer DeWitt, and Allison Dalton Smith.
I would say it's easy, it's fun, it makes a conversation with Congress a lot easier because you have straight-up questions that somebody else has researched and put in front of you.
The magic of it is you enter your phone number and suddenly your phone rings and your congressman is on the other line.
I would say that it's very empowering, and I would suggest that anyone who is thinking about it just take the leap. It's easy and it's quick, and you feel like you're part of something.
This is a long road, but really we have to take it, because if, as acknowledged, our rights to due process recede as we approach the border, and if that border is so mutable that agents may demand our papers on an Amtrak bound from Chicago to New York, and if our representatives, stymied either by politics or DHS stonewalling, can't perform oversight, then those rights truly are at risk. At least we need to know what's going on. So use the tool and help us shed light on DHS. Go to onthemedia.org to find out how.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurkhman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, and Mira Sharma. We had more help from Kimmy Regler. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.